The next matter on our calendar is the case of Sirota versus Villas of St. Albans Bay. And I do appreciate you both being here early. We ask parties to appear early or lawyers to appear early, but they don't always. But we appreciate it, and especially on a day where the roads have been a little bit challenging. So I'm looking at a counsel for appellant, and you have two people at the table. Could you?
Your Honor, I'm Todd Iliff, counsel for appellant, and this is Nathaniel Iliff. He's a law clerk for me. He's my son, and he'll be attending University of St. Thomas Law School this fall.
All right. As a general rule, we do not permit non-lawyers to sit at counsel table.
All right, thank you.
But if you wanted to sit just right behind, that would be fine. Thank you. Welcome to the practice of law, almost.
All right. I would have brought my kids.
Well, they can certainly watch from, but we do limit counsel table to lawyers of record in the case. Anyway, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll let you have a moment to get settled and just remind you of some of our rules. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for the appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent at the beginning of your argument because we are making an audio recording. And then one thing I haven't told anybody else, but I will tell you, is that you have a choice of podiums, and you can use the one closest to you if you just want to maintain more distance. The center podium can be raised and lowered, and that is where the lighting system is that gives you an understanding of the time you have remaining. So it is up to you where you want to, from where you deliver your argument. But with that, we are ready to proceed, and counsel for appellant, you may do so.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. This is a case about a common element tree.
I need you to state your name first. I know I forget it too.
Todd Iliff, Your Honor, counsel for appellant. This is a case about a common element tree in a condominium association on Lake Minnetonka. And it's about the control of the association or the ability of the association to control the common elements as set forth in the recorded covenants on the property. It's about the association's ability to make and enforce its rules in accordance with those covenants. And it's about the ability of the association to levy fines for the enforcement of those rules. The respondents sued under 5 counts, including breach of covenants, breach of duty, declaratory judgment, and also an estoppel, equitable estoppel, and waiver claim that was dismissed on summary judgment. The primary issue that we're here for today is simply this. Can there be a private nuisance on real property where the covenants have been completely complied with? And in this case, the trial court ruled that the association had not breached the restrictive covenants, had not breached its duty under the covenants in trimming the tree, but yet the trial court found that there was a private nuisance as to the existence of the tree because the respondents claimed that it blocks their view of Lake Minnetonka.
Mr. Iliff, before you go further and go into the details of that part of your argument, could you help tell me, did you raise that issue that there was no wrongful conduct as a bar to the private nuisance claim below? I mean, I know you certainly argued, no breach of the duties, no breach of the covenant, but did you say, and they're kind of that next step, and therefore, it bars a private nuisance lawsuit? Because I looked at your summary judgment motion, and you didn't do that there that I saw.
So what we did, Your Honor, below was we argued in response to the respondents' arguments, and that was the breach of the covenants in and of itself created the private nuisance. And I've referenced that in our primary brief. There's several points in their documents and in their arguments in the court below that said the breach itself, the breach of the covenants itself, created the private nuisance. And so we didn't per se argue specifically that there is no private nuisance because we didn't breach, but we argued there is no private nuisance and we didn't breach.
So you're saying the arguments below were intertwined?
They are intertwined, and we've refined that argument here in accordance with some of the case law, the one about the $50,000 in the safe that I cited in the brief. We've refined that argument to say this is an inconsistent ruling, and the reason it's inconsistent is because where we have complied with the covenants, how can, and there's been no showing of any breach of those covenants or violation of those covenants, how can that create a private nuisance in the situation? And the reason being is because the Sirotas, by buying a condominium unit, subjecting themselves to those covenants, have given up certain property rights. They no longer have the unfettered right to look out over that. Their right to look out over that tree is subject to the rights of the association to maintain that tree. That's an exclusive right under the Declaration, Section 12.3.
I'm looking at case law from our court, specifically the Wendinger versus Forest Farms, and then a more recent, I don't know if anyone cited it, Hagen versus Windermere Township. In both cases, our court has focused not so much on wrongfulness of the action, but was there intentional conduct? Was there intentional, for example, in this Hagen case, intentionally maintaining a condition that's injurious to health? I mean, why isn't the permitting this large river birch tree to continue to fill out and grow, as those trees do, maintenance, intentional maintenance of a condition that could support a nuisance claim?
Well, I think the difference, and we did distinguish the Wendinger case in our response and reply brief. In that context, it's not that we didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. But what our position is on this appeal is that where we have restrictive covenants, which are servitudes on land, where we have complied with those, that compliance in and of itself, because it is a restrictive covenant that the Sirotas are subject to, that compliance in and of itself cannot create a private nuisance. If we've complied, it cannot be a private nuisance. And in our original brief, I cited a statutory reference, 515B3-107C, which is part of the Common Interest Ownership Act. And that section gives the association and public service personnel a right of access to units, okay? But for that statute, an owner of a condominium unit could say, hey, association, you can't come into my property. Hey, public service personnel, you can't come into my property, because otherwise that would be a trespass, right? That's trespassing. And in this case, the analogy is that statute, the creation of the condominium subjects it to that statute, and that statute gives us this exception to the rule of trespass. It's the same thing here. It's a similar issue as to the private nuisance. Another analogy that was not cited in our brief, but one that I'd like to point out to the court, and that's this. If we have three, let's say we have three properties, A, B, and C, on a lake. C wants to go visit A, so makes a deal with B. Hey, I want an easement to go across your property. And they dictate the terms of the easement, and they record those terms. C complies with those terms, goes across the property. All of a sudden, B doesn't like it. So B sues for a nuisance or a trespass. B is not entitled to win on that, because they've given up that property right by giving it to, by giving that easement right to C. I'm moving through my argument here a little bit. I think I've addressed, I've addressed the majority of that issue. The other issue, primary issue that we have, excuse me, is as to the 2020 fines that were levied. The trial court ruled that the association abused its discretion in levying those fines, but yet it ruled at the same time that the association had given notice, an opportunity to be heard, and that opportunity to be heard was waived.
Council, I'm looking at the addendum, the October 13, 2020 letter, which set forth the notice and the opportunity to be heard. And as I read the second page, this letter that you wrote, Council, it indicates that the opportunity to be heard that is being offered is solely and exclusively limited to the issue of whether or not you have violated the policy.
Correct.
But it doesn't appear from this letter that you're providing an opportunity to be heard on the fines, because it says two paragraphs up that following the Zoom meeting, the board will consider whether or not to levy fines. So it looks to me that the opportunity to be heard is with respect to whether there was a policy violation, but not as to the fines.
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and there's a little bit of a nuance there, and that nuance is simply this. The fines cannot be levied under 515B3-102A11 of MCIOWA. Fines cannot be levied until after notice and opportunity to be heard. So they have to have their opportunity to be heard, and then the fines may be levied. So the process...
Do they get an opportunity to be heard on the assessment of fines?
They get an opportunity to be heard on the issues of whether or not fines should be assessed. So I think that the answer to that question is yes. And that was the opportunity that was given. So the opportunity to be heard is a precondition to the assessment of fines. So the board cannot assess fines until the opportunity to be heard has been granted.
But the letter indicates that the opportunity to be heard that is being offered is solely and exclusively limited to the issue of whether or not you have violated the policy, which seems to be different than whether fines should accompany a violation of the policy.
Well, yeah, point well taken, and that's a nuance, Your Honor, but I think the nuance is simply this. We complied with the process. We have to go through that process under 3-102A11. It says, after notice and opportunity to be heard. So we've given notice of the violation. We've given notice that there's a potential for fines. We've also given the opportunity to be heard.
And where in the record is the opportunity to be heard on the fines?
It's that same documentation. It's that same series of documentation. There is no separate depiction of an opportunity to be heard specifically with respect to fines. However, there is reference to fines in that document that you're referencing, that fines are potential. There's also another, I see my time is running short, but I wanted to mention that there is a course of dealing here. This is not the first rodeo. These parties have been dealing with this for some time, and in fact, there were 2019 fines that were levied and assessed and paid. That's not an issue here today before us, but the point being that there was a course of dealing here with respect to that issue. I will address a couple of the issues, and I see my time is running short. I will address a couple of the issues with respect to the matters being appealed by the Sirotas. With respect to the breach of covenant claims, the legal conclusions by the trial court are not an abuse of the court's discretion. The trial court found that the intent of the parties with respect to the final plans was not that the final plans be specifically complied with in detail. And the Sirotas spend some time in their response on the issue of the incorporation of the final plans into the declaration, because the declaration mentions the final plans. A careful reading of the cases that they cite indicates that those cases, including Short v. Van Dyke, the Holtorf case, and Granite Re, all reference a specific writing that's made contemporaneously with another writing. In this case, we have a set of final plans that's mentioned in Section 1203 of the Declaration that says simply this. It says, the association shall maintain the rain gardens as located and shown on the final plans and the CIC plat. Interestingly enough, the CIC plat does not even refer in any way, shape, or form to the rain gardens at all.
One of the things, if I may, Mr. Olive, when I looked at this issue that gave me some, just a little pause, was the district court diving into what the party's intents were, but usually we do that if the provisions are ambiguous. I mean, so are these covenants ambiguous?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think they are at all. Section 1203 is pretty straightforward. It says, as located and shown on the final plans in the plat.
And then there's some provision that allows for final plan for field adjustments, right?
Correct.
So if you look at those two, I mean, do we have to get into what the party's intents are? I mean, I don't want to ask you that as well, Mr. McGee.
Well, so the point that I was making was simply this, that just because the final plans are mentioned in the declaration does not mean that they're fully incorporated into the declaration itself. If the parties had originally intended that, they certainly would have made it into a record document. The final plans were not a record document. I will conclude there as I see my time is running out, unless there's further questions.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm David McGee. I'm here representing Elliot and Judy Sirota, who are the owners of property at this association. I'd like to start by just commenting on some of the things that counsel had indicated. And that is, number one, he's claiming that if there's covenants, you can't have a private nuisance. And you'll realize that no case has ever said that. No statute has ever said that. Mikiowa, which is laden with things regarding common interest communities, never says, oh, by the way, you don't have a private nuisance if you're undercovered under covenants. And in fact, cases in other jurisdictions that we've cited to show that no, there is no restriction on the ability of a member to pursue a private nuisance just because there's the existence of covenants. There would make no sense in so doing, because you have to have that ability to take action as an owner of an association, a member of an association. So I think that the argument that would be first time this court has ever rendered such an opinion, and I think that's a better action, because you're talking about statutes. Mikiowa, passed by the legislature, and 561, private nuisance, passed by the legislature. That's for the legislature to make that determination if they want to say, if you comply with this one, you don't get this one.
Well, here I think that the issue, as I read it, becomes, I mean, the reason the whole question about whether this can, as a matter of law, be a private nuisance really reflects the nature of the conduct that created the nuisance, as we say. And it's a negligent failure to trim this tree or take it down or get it out of the way. And I think the stronger argument is that if there's a finding that in fact, wasn't wrongful, that complied with the maintenance responsibilities set forth in the declaration, then it isn't the sort of wrongful conduct that would support a private nuisance recovery.
But such an argument would be inconsistent with a Wedinger case, would be inconsistent, because in the Wedinger case, the requirement of wrongful is not on the person that perpetrated or allegedly created the condition. It's on the harm. And I wish Wedinger and the Supreme Court would have used a better word than wrongful, because in the context of both those cases, the wrongful would normally, you would say, well, the defendant committed a wrongful act and the plaintiff was harmed. But in fact, the word wrongful doesn't apply to that person's conduct. It applies to the person that has been harmed. And if you look at both the Supreme Court case and Wedinger, it said that it is not the conduct of the individual, it is how that conduct is impacted on the victim.
Well, when I look at Whittaker, I see the statement stood out with me is used in this way, the word wrongful is meant simply to limit the scope of nuisance liability to situations in which the defendant can be said to be at fault. So where's, if you substitute the word fault for wrongful, where's the fault based upon, if we agree that the district court's findings on the duties and covenants are not clearly erroneous?
Yeah. Again, in Randall versus Village of Excelsior Supreme Court case, the court defined and said that the injury suffered by the victim, that is what is wrongful, not the conduct of the defendant. You don't need the conduct. If you look at Whittaker, in that Whittaker case, you had a neighboring property owner that was putting on liquid fertilizer on his lawn, okay? And that impacted the victim, the plaintiff. Nowhere in that Whittaker case did the court say, hey, this guy did something wrong. No. It is not the fault of the perpetrator. It's not the fault of the association that you need to be looking at. It is how it impacts. You can have a private nuisance with somebody that didn't commit a wrongful act. You can. And Whittaker and the Supreme Court of this state in Randall said exactly that.
So if I buy a condominium that faces the Mississippi River, and I bought it because I wanted to look out on the Mississippi River, and a neighboring developer said, I want to look out on the Mississippi River too, and I'm going to put a building right in front of this building, are you saying that everybody in building number one has an action for private nuisance against? Why not?
Because I have ownership interest in the property in this case. I own the property. I have an undivided interest in the property. As and a condominium owners have a common element.
How does that make a difference? I mean, you know, my concern isn't necessarily about how the statute interacts with the tort. It's about whether there is a tort at all for an obstruction of a view. And I'm a little dissatisfied with the treatment of the, I think it's the Gunstrom case in your brief, where it is an unpublished opinion, but it does rely on a published opinion that says that there is no private nuisance claim for an obstruction of a view.
It's in that case, Your Honor, this is important because as a common interest community, as an owner in a common, I have a ownership interest in the property. And so therefore, I have a claim. I would agree with you that if I don't have a claim, I don't have a right to raise an objection, which is counterintuitive to the Whittaker case because that person did not own that farm that was getting this fertilizer, but they still had a private right of action, right?
So the nuisance, so the cause of action for nuisance in this case originates from the condominium ownership. It originates solely out of that contractual relationship.
Yes, that relationship is what gives us the ability to take action vis-a-vis the common elements.
I understand.
And I can sense here that you're struggling because it is, most people would say, well, to have a private nuisance, you got to have somebody who did something wrong. Okay, that is not the case. That is not the law. I would encourage you to take a look at both those cases because that is simply not the case. In Whittaker, no finding that this neighboring property owner did anything illegal or improper, and in the Supreme Court case, said the same thing.
Well, but the more recent Supreme Court case, the Highview North Apartments, post-Randall, reiterates that there needs to be some sort of wrongful conduct involved to support a private nuisance claim. The wrongful conduct varies and may at times be characterized as intentional conduct, negligence, ultra-hazardous activity, violations of the statute, or some other tortious activity.
Well, just because the conduct in the case occurred and the person didn't commit a wrong doesn't relieve the possibility. People can do innocent things. People can do things that they don't understand or realize are going to impact other people. But that ability to be able to bring that claim and say, well, your conduct may have been legal and appropriate, but it still had an impact on this person. And if you look at the private nuisance statute, does it say the person engaged in a bad practice? No, it doesn't.
No, our courts have have interpreted that. The common law is developed around it. Well, don't we get back to, yes, your client's property interest distinguishes this case, but didn't your client give up in the declarations the right, the authority to maintain that common area?
I don't believe my client gave up the right. of a private nuisance. I don't think any court has ever made that determination that I have the ability, that because I am a member of an association, I give a right under a statute. Where is that? Where is in the Makiwa does it say, you know, if you're part of an association, you have no private nuisance statute? These are both statutes, and not one says the other one is absolved.
So then what's the point of giving to the association the sole responsibility to maintain, the sole authority to maintain, if you could bring a private nuisance claim anytime you don't like the way they're doing it?
Well, all I can do is cite to the Massachusetts Court of Appeals, which says, in finding a right to a private nuisance, to hold otherwise would leave a unit owner powerless to correct an interference with quiet enjoyment of their property from a condition emanating from the common elements already impacting that owner. In that case, in other cases, in other jurisdictions, they say, we can't leave these owners defenseless. You know, they have a right to protect their property. And so when you get into an association, you don't absolve yourself of all authority to do something. And if the association, despite allegedly following their rules, does something, you should have a remedy. Otherwise, they're remedyless. I mean, one of the things that you've seen from reading the briefs is this association is the sit down and shut up association by the good neighbor policy and by their actions in this case. If you decide that there is no public nuisance ability, or if you assign an obligation on the part of a person that changing the case law and saying, as a member of an association under Makiwa, you can't assert a private nuisance. No court has made that determination, and the legislature hasn't made that determination.
Mr. McGee, yeah. Can I take you back to one of my early questions to Mr. Iliff, which was kind of, did he make this argument below?
Yeah.
So, and he said, well, that you had argued at trial that it was the alleged breach of the covenants and breach of duties that created a private nuisance, and they were, I think my word was intertwined.
I mean,
is that a fair characterization? I just want to get your perspective on
this. Yeah. Having not been born yesterday, I argue alternative theories on the lower court. So, of course, and I firmly believe that they did, in fact, breach the covenants, and I think we cover that in our brief quite thoroughly, and I'm not going to belabor the point now. But the fact is that, you know, we argued both things. We argued, hey, you know, they breached the covenant, but did they ever argue, well, you don't, you know, it doesn't matter?
But did you argue, I mean, I get that you argued they breached the covenants. Got that.
Yeah.
Did you argue that that was part of what created this public? Did you tie that to the nuisance claim? That's
I didn't. I don't believe I did, but I couldn't tell you. I mean, we did argue that they did breach the covenants, okay? And the breach of covenant would have given us what? The remedy of trimming this tree. So, but what I'm trying to emphasize here is that you can't read into the statute that there is a requirement of wrongful conduct, because I think that's inconsistent with the statute, but also inconsistent with the case law. There is one point I want to make on before my time runs out on the issue of the fines. Understand that my client received the letter and an opportunity to be heard. But he didn't receive the letters. He didn't receive what it is. And if one thing is clear in this case, there had been a lot of communication back and forth. So which one of his letters or emails was the subject of it? I mean, it's basic due process.
He responded to them.
What?
He responded to the letter saying, I'm not going to participate, I'm going to court.
Yeah, well, he responded because why would he do so? If he doesn't know the reason, so am I supposed to show up at the hearing or at this opportunity to be heard without any idea of what it is that I allegedly did wrong, and that's my opportunity? I think it's basic due process.
To be fair, I mean, the association said you sent these emails. He presumably has the emails that he sent. There's not a dispute that he sent the emails. So that's what the hearing was about.
Well, I would dare to say that the number of communications back and forth were significant, but wouldn't it be incumbent upon the association to say what letter violated the good neighbor policy? What was that letter? What about that letter violated the good neighbor policy? So I can defend myself.
And that's your argument that as to why the notice was deficient?
Yeah. I mean, it's deficient in that I don't have an opportunity to defend myself. It's kind of almost Kafkaesque. It's like, okay, show up here, and we'll tell you at the time, and I have no opportunity to defend myself or be prepared.
Let me ask a question I was asking your esteemed colleague here about the opportunity to be heard about the fines.
Yeah.
Are you arguing that you did not have an opportunity to be heard about the fines?
We believe we have not had an opportunity to be heard about the substance or the fines.
Okay. And when your client declines to participate in the hearing about the substance, is that sort of a waiver of the complaint about the lack of opportunity to be heard about the fines?
I don't think so, because I think the due process elements of still exist. I mean, the opportunity to know what it is I am fighting for, to know what it is that I have to defend myself from, and to know the issue of whether or not what the amount of those fines are. I mean, I think that's critical.
So can I ask a follow-up question about the fines
yeah.
as well? So the district court decided that the Villas had abused their discretion in levying fines because, as I understand it,
yeah.
they didn't disclose the exact type of violation, but was that, they should? Did you read the district court's order to say there wasn't a they didn't disclose which of those bullets under the policy was violated or which of the emails or conduct by your client violated it or both?
I think it's both because in the letter, which could have easily solved the problem by saying, hey, attaches the 12 emails that make up the basis of our claim, my client would have had an opportunity to rebut them. In fact, many of those letters he wrote to himself. Many of those emails are to himself. And many of those emails are to the property manager, who he's supposed to be able to communicate with, right? So you've got these situations. Well, if he has the letters, has the communication, what's he going to be able to do? Hey, I wrote this to the property manager. You guys said I had to communicate with the property manager, and I wrote that. But they didn't give him that chance. They just said, oh, there's these 12 letters, and you're in trouble. I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes, the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. So I think the key on the issue of the private nuisance is simply this. Section 1201 of the Declaration grants the association the exclusive control. And it's pretty specific, and I don't think there's any need for interpretation. Exclusive control of the common elements. So when the Sirotas buy their condominium unit, they are giving up certain ownership interest rights. And that is the difference here that distinguishes the case law that's been cited. This is a condominium, and because of that, they have given up those rights. If we're following those covenants, and they've given up the right, they've ceded the exclusive right of control over those common elements to the association. What is the association supposed to do? The issue becomes any owner in any condominium can now say, hey, I don't like the way those covenants are cutting against me. I'm going to claim that that's an interference with my free use of property, which
but
it
if,
is.
But if the in this case, your client would just stopped maintaining everything, so was in breach of that duty under the declarations, then there would be a right of recovery. But would you still argue that there's no private nuisance tort claim, that it would be limited to
no,
contract?
That would be the wrongful conduct, Your Honor. So by failing to comply with the covenants, by failing to comply with what they're supposed to do, by failing to discharge their duties in accordance with those covenants, then yes, that would give rise to a number of potential areas of recovery, private nuisance among them. So to go back to my analogy under 3-107 of 515B, if the association barges into a unit without proper cause, that's still a trespass, okay? If they have proper cause, they're fine. If they don't have proper cause, that would be an actionable trespass. So that's the nuance there. You know, a private nuisance claim, what I was going to say is a private nuisance claim is based on the real property rights. Even though the Sirotas do own an undivided interest in the common elements, they have ceded those rights. They have given up those rights to the association. They've given that exclusive dominion and control over those common elements to the association. Like it or not, the association is in control as long as it complies with the covenants. I was going to mention that Mr. McGee mentioned the Massachusetts Supreme Court case. We did, in our reply and response brief, distinguish each of the cases that they cited. And those cases from other jurisdictions tend to focus on a wrongful conduct. So it would be a breach of the covenants. And that's a differentiation in this case. One more issue on the fines. So I did want to point out that as to the fines, Mr. Sirota wrote these emails himself. And as I mentioned earlier, there was a long-term course of dealing. As Mr. McGee indicated, there was a lot of correspondence going back and forth. The letter giving the notice and opportunity to be heard specifically says, your emails, I believe it mentions 13 emails, there ended up being 12 that were found to be a violation. But your 13 emails sent during this period of time are the subject of the hearing. And our contention is that that's specific enough under the statute. The statute says notice. That's notice. He's on notice of what the issues are. If he has questions, he can raise those at the hearing. So
just to be clear, though, you're not saying this is a question of law as far as what the statute says in notice. I mean, this is a factual determination, so we should be looking at this, whether they got notice as a matter of did the district court clearly err, correct?
I concur with that, Your Honor, but here's what the issue is. The trial court said it was an abuse of discretion and pointed to some unknown, unarticulated standard. So there is... The association is not aware of a standard because there is no standard that's known or articulated. The only standard that we have to go by is what's in 515B and in our bylaws and our rules. And we complied with those, and the court so found. So there's some standard that we don't know what it is where we are presumed to have abused our discretion. I see that my time has expired. With that, we simply ask that the... decision on the private nuisance be reversed, and that the decision on the 2020 fines also be reversed, and the matter be remanded for determination of attorney's fees. Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. And that is the final matter on our calendar for oral arguments, so we are in recess.